is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
His security forces have shot people. You know, there have been scores of people killed. There have been widespread beatings. Bobby Wine's car himself has been attacked. He himself has been beaten. I mean, here's like the leading presidential candidate who runs around the country with a helmet and a bulletproof vest. That says it all. You know? So Museveni is clearly terrified that he's going to lose.
That's Kenneth Roth, executive director of the Human Rights Watch, on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's efforts to be reelected again. Details coming up. Also, the UN confirms the deaths of four UN peacekeepers in Mali, and three prominent members of Tigray's People's Liberation Front, TPLF, have been killed in Ethiopia. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Today, Ugandans go to the polls for the country's presidential election. President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in office more than 30 years, faces 11 other candidates. The top challenger, however, is Robert Chagulani, known as Bobby Wine. Over the past 2 months of campaigning, security forces repeatedly have broken up opposition rallies and events and arrested, beaten, or shot scores of people in what the government says is an effort to prevent violence and attempts to interfere in the election. It has shut down access to the internet across the country. Catherine Numbi is on the ground in Kampala, visiting polling stations and talking to voters in the country's presidential election today. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about what she's seen, and she starts by talking about the long delays at voting places.
So some polling stations had to start like 4 or 5 hours late, others 2 hours late, but now polling is going on smoothly. And the voter turnout has been generally good in most parts of the country. Yeah, people enthusiastically made the long queues despite the heavy security presence at the polling stations. All the 11 presidential candidates have been able to cast their ballots in different parts of the country.
Now, you mentioned the security at the polling places. What has security been like? Is it heavier in areas where there is more opposition support? Has there been any reports of arrest, that sort of thing?
No, there have not been any reports of arrest so far, but security is really tight, especially in the urban centers, the city centers. Kampala is almost like a barracks, I would say. There is the army, there is the police in all sorts of uniform. So security is tight. And if you look at Kampala now, it's a bit deserted. Most people are out. People did not open their shops, I think, because they were voting. And mostly all you can see are security people making lines across the town. Then you also can see like security in uniform. So security is really tight. Even at the polling stations, you can identify like 4 or 5 security officers at a particular polling station. And the army has said they are to ensure that all presidential candidates are well guarded until the final announcement. So security is really tight, but so far there are no reports of violence, there are no reports of arrests. It is still calm.
All right. Now, what are people saying about the election, about the voting? How are people feeling today?
There is a mixed feeling. There are people who feel their vote will be rigged because there are people who have reported some incidents of vote rigging, ballot stuffing. Some are saying there are those who are double voting, so the Electoral Commission says they are taking this on to see those areas and where possible they will nullify the election. So people are anxiously looking forward to that. And many are still at the polling stations, despite the earlier warning that they should return to their homes after voting. Many decided to at least stay within 20 meters from the polling station as the constitution allows it, the law allows it. So they are waiting around for the final voting, for the final counting. That will be after 4 p.m. Kampala time. And then after the final counting at the polling stations, there will be a tallying at the tally center. So the people are still at the polling station. Some few stayed at the polling stations to wait for the counting.
That's journalist Catherine Nambi in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pounderson. Tensions are high for the election as soldiers and police in riot gear patrol the capital of the East African country of 46 million people, with reports of panic buying in case violence breaks and drags on. Some voters said they feared the security force but were determined to vote. 56 people were reported killed during the two-month election campaign. The government imposed strict campaigning rules that it said were aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19, but opponents claimed that was aimed at cracking down on opponents. Kenneth Throth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, said the rules weren't applied evenly.
President Museveni has used the pandemic as an excuse to quash the political rallies of his principal opponent, Bobi Wine, while allowing his rallies to go forward.
Lines grew as some polling stations opened late and the internet blackout interfered with some voting machines, forcing a switch to paper ballots. Roth says all the government tactics reflect Museveni's concern that young voters, many of whom were not born when he took power nearly 35 years ago, might favor Bobi Wine.
His security forces have shot people. You know, there have been scores of people killed. There have been widespread beatings. Bobi Wine's car himself has been attacked. He himself has been beaten. I mean, here's like the leading presidential candidate who runs around the country with a helmet and a bulletproof vest. That says it all. You know, so Museveni is clearly terrified that he's going to lose.
Results are expected by Saturday. If no candidate gets at least 50% of the vote, a runoff election will be held. The UN mission in Mali, known as MINUSMA, has confirmed the deaths of 4 United Nations peacekeepers and the wounding of 6 others. Reuters reports a convoy struck an explosive device and came under fire. It was not clear who carried out the attack about 20 kilometers north of the town of Bambara in the Timbuktu region. The dead peacekeepers were from Ivory Coast. Islamic groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State operate in the region and have made much of the West African country ungovernable. The attack occurred a day after a UN Security Council meeting devoted to peace efforts in Mali. The conflict, which has killed thousands of soldiers and civilians in Mali, has spread to neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger, inflaming ethnic tensions along the way. Africa is set to soon receive about 270 million coronavirus vaccines, the African Union says, and officials hope to see the doses distributed equitably across the continent. It's the first major shipment of what health experts say are the 1.5 billion doses they will need to vaccinate enough Africans to achieve herd immunity. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For slightly more than 2 months, a task team at the African Union, a 55-member organization of African states, has worked to try to make sure the continent gets its share of coveted coronavirus vaccines. Late Wednesday, the AU announced it had done so, with the first 270 million vaccines on their way. That is just under a fifth of the 1.5 billion doses officials think they'll need to vaccinate around 70% of the continent. That is the rough threshold to achieve herd immunity. Tyrone Seal is spokesman for South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who currently serves as AU chairman.
President Ramaphosa said that from the onset of this pandemic, our focus as a continent has been on collaboration and collective effort. We've held steadfastly to the principle that no country should be left in mind. And with this in mind, we have not only campaigned vigorously for changes through all the available international forums, but we've taken the additional step to independently secure vaccines using our own limited resources as member states.
In a separate announcement last week, officials in South Africa, the continent's coronavirus hotspot, announced it would receive 1 million India-manufactured doses by the end of January and another 500,000 in February. South Africa hopes to vaccinate 40 million people, about 67% of the population, by year's end. South Africa has seen just under 1.3 million confirmed cases since the virus arrived in March. The second wave of the virus, featuring a new variant that appears to be more contagious, began in December. But low-income countries do not have the same access to the market as nations like South Africa, which is a member of the G20 economic grouping. So the AU made a plan, according to Seal.
In terms of financing, arrangements have been made with Afrexim Bank to support member states who want to access these vaccines based on a whole-of-Africa approach. And the bank will, upon receipt of firm orders from member states, provide advanced procurement commitment guarantees of up to $2 billion to the manufacturers on behalf of member states. There's also close collaboration between the AU team and the World Bank to ensure that member states are able to access about $5 billion either to buy more vaccines or to pay for delivery of vaccines committed on their behalf by the bank.
Seal added that about 50 million doses will arrive between April and June, which is considered to be a critical period. The remaining doses will be available this year, he said. The India-manufactured vaccines come from Pfizer and AstraZeneca. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Ethiopia, three prominent members of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, have been killed and five other party members were captured. The French news agency AFP, quoting a government statement, reports that the dead included Siyum Mesfin, who served as Ethiopia's foreign minister for nearly two decades, along with former Federal Affairs Minister Abai Sahaye and ex-parliamentary chief Asmallah Shewalda Selassie. The officials were targets of a military operation in the country's northern Tigray region and were killed because they refused to surrender, according to the government statement. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered troops into Tigray in early November in response to TPLF orchestrated attacks on federal army camps. Airstrikes and battles since early November are believed to have killed thousands of people. The UN says more than 2 million people in the region need aid. Rights groups are urging Zimbabwean authorities to drop charges against a prominent journalist and two senior opposition members accused of peddling falsehoods. A Harare court denied bail today to journalist Hopewell Chinono, who faces up to 20 years in prison if convicted. Activists say the charges against the three are part of the government's efforts to stifle critics, as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Harare Magistrate Lanzini Ncube ruled Thursday that journalist Hopewell Chinono had a high chance of skipping the country or may commit more offenses if granted bail. Paida Moyo Saurombe from Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, the organization representing Chinono and the two opposition politicians, has a different point of view.
It is our considered view that Mr. Chinono is not a convicted criminal. He has not been convicted of any crime in the past. And hence to say that he has a propensity to commit other offenses whilst on bail would be a gross misdirection on the part of the court.
Saurombe said his client will appeal to the High Court to overturn the magistrate's ruling. Decisions on bail for opposition leaders Job Scala and Fadzai Mahere will be made Friday. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says the charge of peddling falsehoods, which the three face, was removed from Zimbabwe statute books by the Constitutional Court in 2014. Robert Chivambu, the spokesman for Amnesty International in Southern Africa, is urging the government to drop the charges, which he says are part of a crackdown on opposition leaders human rights activists, journalists, and any voices critical of the government.
It is consistent with the constant harassment and intimidation that we have seen against anyone who demands respect for human rights, transparency, and accountability in Zimbabwe in recent past. The government must stop treating dissent as enemies of the state and allow human rights, including the right to freedom of expression, to thrive in Zimbabwe.
When asked for a comment, Nick Mangwana, Zimbabwe's information secretary, had this reaction.
The decision on who is prosecuted and who is not rests with the prosecutor general in Zimbabwe. Our constitution is very clear that that decision by the prosecutor general should not be influenced by anybody. In this particular case, one can actually infer that Amnesty International is interfering with the justice delivery system in Zimbabwe, which should not be, which is wrong, because the state, the government itself cannot tell the prosecutor general on who charges should be withdrawn against and who charges should be pursued against.
Right.
Absolutely wrong and interfering.
The three defendants, Chingono, Mahere, and Sikala, were arrested for commenting on a video in which citizens accused police officers of fatally assaulting a baby who was on her mother's back. Police later issued a statement saying both the mother and the baby were never assaulted. Columbus Mavrungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
In Africa, policymakers, aid agencies, and grassroots activists agree education is key if the continent is to compete effectively amid globalization. Until recently, the Samburu, a traditional pastoralist people in remote northeastern Kenya, had little access to the education needed to cope with the encroaching modern world. One U.S.-based nonprofit group is working with tribal elders to build and maintain 21st-century schools while keeping crucial aspects of the Samburu's ancient desert culture alive and well. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The Samburu are a semi-nomadic people who depend on their ancient skills and wits to survive in the desert with their cattle, goats, and camels. Their warriors carry spears, and their women are adorned with elaborate, brilliantly colored beads that denote their status within the tribe. Thorn Tree Project founder Jane Newman says the Samburu live far away from modern Africa.
They're very isolated, and they're cut off from the rest of the world. There's no roads, no telephones, no prenatal care, no running water, nothing.
Newman first met the Samburu in 1999 when her vehicle broke down on a backcountry adventure. During her brief stay with them, she was struck by their hospitality and their sense that education might be their culture's lifeline.
Before I met them, all the elders had realized that the modern world was encroaching, and they realized they were not at all prepared for it. They couldn't speak English or Kiswahili, they couldn't communicate with the outside world, they didn't know what resources were available that they could ask for or how to ask for them, and also they were afraid of being taken advantage of. So they asked us, me at the time, if I could help them get more of their kids to go to school.
Newman returned about 2 years later, ready to help.
At that time, in the two pre-primary schools, they had 130 students and maybe about a quarter of them graduated. But their main problem and the main thing that we deal with is the fact that they're nomadic. So these three schools that are in their area are anywhere from 10 to 100 kilometers away from the family. So if they're migrating or moving, their children have to go to boarding school. So that was clearly a problem because they didn't have any real boarding facilities.
And the other issue was that few of them had been to school and most didn't know what school was. So the Thorn Tree Project started with two preschools.
And they've been hugely successful. We actually have 15 of them now. They're run by the community. They make all the decisions. A warrior with at least 2 years' experience is the teacher or a mother. So they usually have like a spear in one hand and a piece of chalk in the other. And there's no building, it's just mobile. So they find the largest shady thorn tree around, prop a blackboard up against a tree trunk, and then that's the school. when you go and visit them, you'll see like 30, 40 tiny children sitting around loving it.
Today, nearly 1,400 Samburu attend preschool or primary school. Over 150 young people have received Thorn Tree scholarships for secondary school, which is the normal gateway in Kenya to higher education at a trade school or university, which many have also now attended. Not that their need for Western-style education means the Samburu are ignorant. Newman says that's far from the case.
Because they have this huge education program themselves, because looking after cows in the desert is extremely difficult. In fact, if you try to live their life and succeed, you'd be really hard-pressed. So there's a huge body of knowledge which is passed on to the mothers, the children, the warriors, from the older people over a long period of time that is their formal education. It usually takes place around ceremonies and so on, but there's a lot of instruction.
For example, the Samburu pass on information culled during a horrific drought a century ago about which plants might thrive and where during current dry spells. The Thorn Tree Project works with elders to ensure this knowledge is preserved in the push for Western education and the jobs that may follow.
In fact, the elders themselves see this as a way to protect their culture. If you go to school, you can get a job. So during a bad drought, and the droughts are very frequent and escalating in intensity, somebody that's working in and got a job can send money home, and there's no malnutrition in that family. And also at the end of the drought, when they've lost all their animals, that person will be able to help them to buy two cows so that they can start up again. So that was definitely an insurance policy for their culture.
Education allows the Samburu to take jobs previously held by others sent to the region by the Kenyan government. But the region is considered a hardship post, and many from the outside don't deal well with conditions there.
So we had a series of nurses that were either drunk or just never turned up, that couldn't speak Samburu, didn't care about the patients. And one of our very first students that went to high school did a two-year diploma in nursing in Mombasa. And when I was there in April, he'd just come back, finished, and he was there at the clinic. And it was just amazing because he could speak the language. He knew all the families, and he slept over the top of the dispensary. So the whole community was just delighted.
Other jobs that now go to Samburu who've been educated through the Thorn Tree Project include school teachers and rangers at a nearby nature reserve. Many now also work in the tourism and hospitality industries. Jane Newman's friend, Clodagh, an Irish-born interior and fashion designer based in New York, has raised funds for the Thorn Tree Project from the start. During one of her many trips to the region, Clodagh got a happy surprise in a remote game lodge far from the Ndanya Wasson area where many Samburu live.
Behind the desk was this really beautiful woman, and she said, "Oh, where are you coming from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not sure you'd know where. It's a remote place in the Ndanya Wasson." "Oh," she said, "I went to school there. I was in the boarding school there." It turns out she was one of our pupils. I'm not going to cry now, but I cried then. I mean, we were hugging each other and crying. It was so wonderful that we actually had created a job through education for somebody who's now working in tourism. There's nothing abstract about it. It's physical, it's hugging, it's just very important.
The Thorn Tree Project owes much of its success to the personal connections it fosters. Its administration is 100% volunteer, so all contributions go to schools, infrastructure, and scholarships, not bureaucracy. Both Jane Newman and Clodagh say that as the Thorn Tree Project continues to grow, its emphasis will broaden as well. Future plans include greater opportunities for girls and women to become leaders within the Samburu tribe and in Kenya overall. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhibe in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo, and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC right after the International